standing up in things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fight beside of me. Yeah, walking on the fight beside of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting men who've died to be. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fight inside me. Some squirrely guy who claims he just don't believe in the fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fight inside of me. Yeah, walking on the fight inside of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in a fought and died to be. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fight inside of me. Yeah, walking on the fight inside me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in the fog of death. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fight inside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fight inside of me, and that's the name of this program here on LightResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people, and of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, good news today. There was the petition, online petition, that was started last Monday to support hockey broadcaster Don Cherry, who was unceremoniously fired by Rogers. That's the big cable company that owns Hockey Night in Canada. Fired because he made some comments mildly critical of those immigrants who don't care enough about Canada to bother to wear a poppy to honor our veterans. He made those comments last Saturday. All hell broke loose. He was fired. And to their everlasting shame and discredit, the NHL, National Hockey League, denounced him and said that he did not represent their values of inclusion and diversity. I don't think you have to be an intellectual heavyweight to wonder, well, doesn't that include diversity of opinion? And if you're all for diversity, well, and inclusion, why don't you include Don Cherry? Similarly, then the Royal Canadian Legion, and as for their veterans, that Don Cherry's remarks had been made, urging people to wear the poppy, and you buy a poppy with a small donation, whatever donation you'd like, and the proceeds go to the veterans as administered by the Royal Canadian Legion. Now, as I mentioned on other broadcasts, I have a big problems with the Royal Canadian Legion. They've fallen into the clutches of utterly pro-censorship, politically correct people. And I would not willingly support them. I do honor and support veterans. Anyway, Don Cherry was fired. There's immediately an online petition. It's now up to 256,000 signatures. That is as of earlier today. And for the second time in 4 days, there was a protest outside the offices of Rogers in downtown Toronto at the corner of Mount Pleasant and Bloor. Several groups, the Yellow Vests, the Canadian Nationalist Party, and my own Canadian Association for Free Expression were there. I was so glad to see photos. I was not there myself. I'm at the other end of the country right today. But it was so good to see the flag dominating that protest was the old red ensign, and I say it's the flag of the real Canada. It represents the values and the traditions of our country, making it quite clear we're British and we're European. Those are the founding settler people. The present Canadian flag is a symbolically awkward, it looks like the logo of an insurance company. Anyway, the protesters were there demanding that Don Cherry be rehired. And none of the signs, I thought, they nailed that things down quite well. One of the signs there at the protest, let's see here. Nailed the political correctness and focused on such things as the cancel culture, and that's one of the main approaches of the Red Guards of cultural Marxism. Cancel. We hear something we don't like, you must be silenced, fired, not allowed a platform. If we don't like what you're going to what you said, you must be destroyed. Gone are the days where somebody might offer you a counter opinion, say, well, you know, you're wrong, or you're partly right, or here are the reasons. No, you said something against immigrants, you must be destroyed, despite the fact that he had a 37-year career. So I like the signs there about the opposing this cancel culture of brainless mayhem and political correctness. And secondly, there was a sign there calling on for the defunding of the CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, which costs the taxpayers over $1 billion a year in subsidy, and really subsidizes just far left cultural Marxist propaganda and much of its program. So yeah, so good stuff. I give these folks top marks for showing up today, and it was cold. I was told it was brutally cold. And you know, this is on the 16th of November. Now there are parts of Canada where low temperatures might be expected at this time of year, but Toronto would not normally be brutally cold. And you know, every time that happens, I urge other people to make that comment to other people, and you know, say things like, "Geez, it must be global warming." You know, yeah. You know, let's keep calling nonsense, as we hear it, exactly for what it is, nonsense. I've been doing some thinking lately, you know, about language. And you know, that's one of the ways that we are manipulated and controlled. I should say, efforts are made to manipulate us and control us. And one of the people who first mentioned this in a very organized and thoughtful way was the great British author George Orwell, who wrote a novel called 1984, looking at totalitarianism and predicting what the world would be like. He saw that there would be efforts by an all-controlling state to monitor us And of course, we now know that from the Surveillance Society. And also to control us. And he invented a form of English called Newspeak. And he said this would be the type of language that the new totalitarian order would use. And language was not, and this was an interesting insight on his part. Language was not so much a vehicle convey meaning or to describe reality, but was a vehicle, number one, to mislead and to manipulate. Words were not so much a concept to convey concepts or ideas, but to manipulate you emotionally. And for instance, in the world of 1984, the Ministry of Truth was in fact the Ministry of Lies, the Ministry of Propaganda. The Ministry of Peace was actually the War Department, the Ministry of War. So some words were the exact opposite of what the reality was. In other words, language was used not to convey truth, but to lie, to hide truth. And, you know, we see that in a number of politically correct terms today. For instance, the terms I mentioned in regards to Don Cherry and the criticism of him, these organizations like the National Hockey League the Royal Canadian Legion stand for inclusion and diversity. Now, on the surface, they may sound good. Inclusion would suggest, we welcome everybody. Everybody's welcome, sort of a big group hug. But it doesn't mean that. You see, if your organization says, well, in order to be inclusive, we will not make any mention of Christmas this year. And we'll talk about, the usual euphemisms, the holidays, happy holidays, or season's greetings, or so on. So the idea is that includes everybody. No, it excludes Christians. It's a deliberate insult and obfuscation. Similarly, diversity. If your organization is championing diversity, what it actually means is it's anti-white. Anti-white and anti-male and anti-Christian. If your organization embraces diversity, what it means is they don't want more people like you. They don't want you. They want other people. So diversity, while on the surface may seem to mean we include everybody, and that's a good thing. It's presented to us as a good thing. In fact, it's another way of excluding and pushing aside white people. Accusation made against Don Cherry and certain other people is that their comments are divisive. And that's supposed to be a bad thing. And that falls into the category of words that we have been led to believe are moral judgments. And these are accusations that we don't want to be, we don't want them focused on us. So certain remarks are divisive, and that's bad. But when you think about it, at any time you say anything that's opinionated, there will be some people who will agree with you and others who will disagree with you. I guess to some extent that's divisive. Some people say, yay, that's my guy. And other people will say he's an idiot. Well, what's wrong with that? But you see, the accusation of derision and divisiveness only goes, is only used against what you might call white nationalist points of view, or unpopular interpretations of history. If somebody says, we need more third world immigration to boost the economy, and I object to that. I say, I don't want my country continually or increasingly invaded, and eventually the European founding settler people will be overwhelmed. I can't say, well, your comments are divisive. It's always one-sided. Well, now there's some other emotional words that are used to control us. For instance, the term racist. Now, that was, and I think we always have to remember this. This was invented by a man named Lev Davidovich Bronstein. And if that name doesn't immediately ring a bell, that his more usual name was the name change he adopted, Trotsky. He was a radical, militant, international communist who eventually fell out with Stalin. He has militant followers still, they're called the Trotskyists. They're very big on world revolution. And in the internal battles within the old Soviet Union, there was a battle between communists who want to basically emphasize building up a communist state within the Soviet Union, and there would be more inward-looking people like Stalin, and then those who want to get out and spread the revolution across the world. There are people like Trotsky. So the term he used for his enemies were racists. And it was supposed to, first of all, it's a negative word. It's meant to convey, you know, if you're a racist, you're bad. And the idea was that these people were narrow-minded. They only wanted to concentrate on the people of the Soviet Union rather than spread it to all communism to all people. So that's how the word came into the language in the 1920s and 30s. Now the word is very much pejorative. We don't want to be called a racist. I don't care. Because I want to know, well, what is it? What are you calling me? It's supposed to mean bad. And the delightful thing about terms like that is they're very vague. They can be used wherever a angry enemy wishes to use them. So let me try to grasp what racism might be. So supposing I say blacks, Negroes, are disproportionately incarcerated in Canada, or the United States for that matter, because they disproportionately commit usually violent crime. So that's why the Canada Negroes constitute perhaps, 2% of the population, but are heavily overrepresented in the prisons. Now, that statement I've just made would have been what might be called racist. Why? Well, I notice something negative about a race or a group of people, and to some extent, I blame them. Supposing I say the same thing. Blacks are disproportionately incarcerated in Canada and the United States. And that's because of systemic racism. The system is against them. Although in Canada, our judicial system is just riddled with cultural Marxists. I mean, it's unbelievable that the system is racist. But so the argument would go, that statement wouldn't be racist. What is that? Well, you see, people might define racism as attributing different qualities to different races. You're not supposed to do that because we're all equal. But sometimes it's okay. You see what I mean? The term is so loosey-goosey that it can be used at will against people they don't like. You know, in Canada, if you criticize our open-door immigration policy, that's basically changing our demographics. The European founding settler people at the present rate will be a minority by 2050. You say, well, that's not a good thing. You know, it would be better if we remain a solid majority. Well, that's racist. You criticize the immigration policy. So it's an emotional word, very vague in its meaning, and it's used to control. Another term that you'll see a great deal of is appropriate, or it's negative, inappropriate. And you will hear that, you'll read that that statement is inappropriate, or that action is inappropriate. And you know, you might want to ask, well, okay, well, what does that mean? Well, that's where it gets a little bit fuzzy. Inappropriate is a delightful term to say, I don't agree with it. It's wrong. I say it's wrong. So if somebody tells me that an action was, or a comment I made was inappropriate, I don't have any guidance as to, well, okay, what did I say that was wrong? Did I call somebody a bad name? What was it? It's inappropriate. Why? Well, all that conveys is that the accuser disapproves. That's inappropriate. When I was in teacher's college, I didn't learn very much, but one of the things I did learn, and this did make sense, is never to ask a question, and this would usually be with elementary school children, that essentially is, guess what's in the teacher's mind today? For instance, if you come into class and you say, what do you think I did on the weekend? Well, how's the kid supposed to know, unless you've given them some hint? Or, what do you think I'm thinking about today? Well, how are they supposed to know? It's unknowable. And similarly, if you're going to criticize somebody, you should make it quite clear what the grounds for that criticism is. So that, you'll say, people of goodwill might say, well, okay, I'll try to avoid that. Now, I understand what you mean. Inappropriate is simply a catch-all denunciation. And, of course, one that we keep coming up against all the time, and that's hate speech. So, that is hate speech. Or, we're not going to allow that speaker. In fact, I was prevented from presenting myself as a delegation or making a short presentation to the Hamilton City Council on a free speech issue, actually. And some of the groups that opposed might even be heard, you see. We're afraid I might use it as a platform for hate speech. And you see, that's a control word, hate speech. It's an empty denunciation. Now, I tried to point out in press interviews that hate speech almost never has any basis in reality. Literally, under Canadian law, you could only denounce somebody for hate speech if that person has been charged, tried, and convicted under Section 319 of the Canadian Criminal Code. That is willful promotion of hate. Now, I don't believe in the law. I think it's a wrong law. But strictly speaking, it's only hate speech if a person is being convicted. So you can't say, we're not going to allow him to speak, because he might use it as a platform for hate speech. You know, you can't even make that accusation unless and until the speech is being heard and charges, if any, are being laid, and a person convicted. What it is, though, is a useful tool for silencing people. That's hate speech. What that, in fact, it means is, these are comments that the accuser hates. When somebody says, accuses somebody of, that's hate speech, or that speaker has involved himself in hate speech. What it really means is, I don't like that speaker's views. It's a control mechanism. You know, these are things we have to be aware of, and we have to be prepared to push back against. Here's a very interesting write-up about modern art. Now, I'm no fan of modern art. No, that's not because I'm an old fogey. Modern art is usually abstract. But modern art doesn't have mean that it comes out of this particular modern era. There are many good artists today, impressionists, realists, and so on. It doesn't really have to do with a time frame. I would tend to call this art abstract art. And it's art that requires no talent. For instance, there was a famous painting about 20 years ago, and the Art Gallery of Canada was criticized for having bought it because I think, and you have to realize this is 20 years ago, they spent over $1 million on something that was called Pillar of Fire. So what was Pillar of Fire? Let me describe it to you. You'll be able to have no trouble in imagining it. It was three bars, vertical bars, you know, like a bar graph. Two, I believe, were blue. They were shorter. And then there was one in the middle, and it was red. It was taller than the others. This was called Pillar of Fire. And that was worth over $1 million. Or at least, I'd say it was worth 25 cents, but the National Art Gallery paid over $1 million for it. Why would I criticize that? Well, first of all, what does it convey in terms of meaning? Heaven only knows. If this were actually a bar graph, there would be a legend to it. We would know what the two blue columns meant and what the red one meant. But there's no such thing there. Well, does it take any talent? Like a realist's painting, you know, or a great portrait painting, captures the face, maybe even the personality of the subject. And it takes a great deal of talent in terms of the drawing and the color. Does Pillar of Fire require that? Well, no. I would say a senior elementary school child, you know, get given a ruler to be able to draw the lines, these tall rectangles, and some paint should be able to do it. Now, that's not talent. There's nothing creative about it. Anyway, that's why I don't like modern art. Well, why is modern art in some quarters popular? Well, this is why I find this article extremely good. This is by Josiah Knott. Modern art is not really art at all, but Jewish self-promotion and degeneracy. So, though Jews are not heavily represented in true art, they are in fact very much overrepresented in so-called modern art. In fact, they were and are the dominant force in it. Because painting, sculpture, and music are more difficult to counterfeit than philosophy, it was necessary to transform and support Jewish modern art with philosophy in order to make the naive Gentiles accept it as genuine. True art is difficult to counterfeit, and even more difficult to genuinely create. But 20th century Jews never had any interest in such an endeavor in the first place. Instead, by using their strongest attribute, their talent for the creation of false and insidious philosophical theories, like communism, Jewish art critics and art theorists managed to persuade the educated public in the Western world, or many of them, that utter foolishness and frivolousness, simple childish nonsense and outright ugliness are in fact art. All of this was achieved through pseudo-philosophical art critique. In other words, Jews set themselves up as the interpreters or the critics and tell us what to think. Not to trust our instincts, but to tell us what to think. For instance, there's been many atrocities like Piss Christ. And it means exactly what it sounds like. It was a statue, it was a crucifix stuck in a bucket of urine called Piss Christ. And the Jewish artists and the many Jewish critics thought this was, they were trying to make people believe, instead of being sacrilegious garbage, that this was somehow high art. And what does it convey other than utter contempt for Christianity? In my view, that's the view of the writer. Jewish philosophy really ought not to be called philosophy at all. Philo means love, and Sophia is wisdom, or the love of wisdom. Could anyone reasonably claim that the creator of deconstruction, the Algerian French Jew Jacques Derrida, for instance, loves wisdom? Derrida would be the first to insist that he does not even believe in truth. And how can there be wisdom without truth? No, Jewish philosophy ought more properly to be called sophistry, which is how Plato and Aristotle characterized the specious and intentionally dishonest and misleading methods of their philosophical opponents, who, in order to persuade the unsuspecting and win in debate, would twist words to make the weaker argument appear the stronger. Does it sound familiar? And of course, deconstruction is an approach, is a Jewish approach in many of the social sciences, to tear down classics. We've often heard that modern literature departments don't want anything to do with dead white males, so out go people, writers like Charles Dickens or William Shakespeare. And the following paragraph from Saul Lewitt's Paragraphs on Conceptual Art perfectly illustrates the way the Jewish art theory has taken over, trivialized, and destroyed the arts. And I will refer to the kind of art in which I'm involved as conceptual art. Is conceptual art the idea or concept, sorry, in conceptual art, the idea or concept is most important, is the most important aspect of the work. When an artist uses a conceptual form of art, it means that all of the planning and decisions are made beforehand, and the execution is a perfunctory affair. The idea becomes a machine that makes the art. This kind of art is not theoretical or illustrative of theories. It is intuitive. It is involved with all types of mental processes, and it is purposeless. I mean, this sounds like nuttiness. It is usually free from the dependence on the skill of the artist or of a craftsman. So if the art has little to do with the skill of the artist or the craftsman, well, what is it? Or is it something really anybody can do, like pillar fire? Is the objective of the artist who's concerned with conceptual art to make his work mentally interesting to the spectator, and therefore usually he would want it to become emotionally dry? There is no reason to suppose, however, that the conceptual artist is out to bore the viewer. It's only the expectation of an emotional kick, to which one conditioned to expressionist art is accustomed, that would deter the viewer from perceiving this art. Well, gobbledygook. And the writer, Josiah Nott, says, I highly recommend Tom Wolfe's book on modern art, The Painted Word, and his follow-up book on modern architecture, From Bauhaus to Our House, an excellent exposés of the characters who made and promoted modern art and architecture. Though Tom Wolfe does not use the word Jew, even a quick perusal of the book, especially The Painted Word, will reveal who was behind the cultural con job that was and is modern art. The expression painted word is a reference to the fact that modern art is entirely based on art theory, hence it is effectively painted theory. Aesthetician Arthur Danto has even claimed that art is dead, precisely because art has transformed into philosophy or art theory. The Jewish theory behind modern art is intended to explain the art, so as to make naive Gentiles think that such art has great value. Without such theory, normal people would immediately recognize that such degenerate and primitivistic trash is not art at all. And that's right. You see, when somebody has to tell you, now this is great art, and you don't see it, you're probably being conned. For instance, what would there be valuable in the pillar of fire? Or pillars of fire? Well, nothing. Well, would it be any different if these pillars were horizontal? Well, probably some Jewish modern art critic would tell you, no, vertical, that's great art. Horizontal, doesn't mean anything. You see, art should be approachable to the average intelligent person. Now, an art critic, for instance, can, or art historian, can help give you additional information about the artist, maybe increase your understanding. But if you have to rely on a critic to tell you this is good and this is bad, then it probably is bad. The painted word features a number of photographs of the main players in the 20th century art world, and not surprisingly, they're almost all Jewish. Art critic, that is charlatan, Harold Rosenberg, looks like the devil himself. This includes the artists and their promoters, such as con man Clement Greenberg, the Jew who promoted the art of the alcoholic degenerate Jackson Pollock, who actually was not Jewish but was married to a Jewess. Greenberg would buy Pollock's paintings at cut-rate prices, write glowing articles about Pollock's brilliance as an artist, wait for the demand for Pollock's paintings to skyrocket, and then sell the paintings at exorbitant prices. A fine swindle, that. That's just market manipulation. Flipping through the rest of the book reveals pictures of the so-called artists and art promoters, Barnard Newman, Leo Steinberg, Robert Rauschenberg. Rauschenberg was also homosexual, among others. Overall, the book provides an excellent look at the way a series of destructive, culturally subverting Jewish so-called theories transformed what was the noble and beautiful tradition of Western art into yet another grotesque Jewish deformation and mockery. Jewish opposition to truth in philosophy and the social sciences is paralleled by Jewish opposition to beauty in the arts. Why do these self-promoting charlatans always call the gang of degenerate artists they advocate a movement? I suppose it's because they know that they will have to close ranks to defend the art they would like to foist upon us in order to deflect the natural and understandable reaction against it. In order to humiliate us into acceptance and acquiescence by claiming from atop the ivory tower that all those who don't understand the new art are Philistines and cretins. And most people, and especially upper-middle-class whites, care a great deal about being seen to have the correct views on culture. Thus, they are cowed by our Jewish cultural elites into accepting, or at least paying lip service, to what they know deep down cannot possibly be true art. And that's why, in terms of art and music, trust your instincts. A similar process is surely at work with respect to the mainstream Gentile acceptance of all the absurd and pernicious theories and philosophies advocated by intellectual Jewish Jews throughout the 20th century. Most people are utterly incapable of resisting, let alone challenging, what they have been repeatedly told by those in authority, however absurd and patently false what they are told might be. If the proverbial average Joe were to come up with something as totally bizarre and counterintuitive as deconstructionism, for instance, he would be being laughed at and ignored. But if a Jewish intellectual at a major university advocates such a theory, all pay him respect. I've come to believe, and the I here is the writer, Josiah Knott, I've come to believe that there is no view or theory so absurd or perverse that it would not be believed by at least some Gentiles of a major Jewish academic created and promoted. Jews, of course, know all this, which is why the colonization of the centers of Western intellectual life and power was necessary for their subversive and destructive theories to be accepted by large numbers of Gentiles, and hence, cultural Marxism. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me. I'm going to take my musical break now, and I'm going to play some music by a man who has a great voice and a great entertainer. His name is Boxcar Willie, and this is a medley of his songs. Now we're totally next level. Let's suppress this ad.
I'm going to do you a little medley of Hank Williams songs. If you hear one you like, you tell me about it, okay? I tried so hard, my dear, to show that you're my every dream. Yet you're a pretty thing I do is just some evil scheme. The more I learn to care for you, the more we drift apart. Why can't I free your doubtful mind and melt your cold, cold heart? Here's my favorite, ladies and gentlemen. set me right. You wanted me to see you change your name. I couldn't stand to see you wed another. Oh, wedding bells would never ring for me. Oh, I wish we could sing Hank songs all night, but we don't have time to do them all. I've had the pleasure of playing in 41 countries around the world, ladies and gentlemen, and I've never been anywhere yet, no matter what language they spoke, if somebody didn't know this next song of Hank Williams. Here's the song that made his name famous all around our world. I got a feeling called a blue Lord, since my baby said goodbye. Lord, I don't know how to do. All I do is sit inside. Oh, Lord, that last long day she said goodbye. Well, Lord, I told her would die. She'll do me, she'll do you. She got the kind of love. Lord, I love to hear her when she called me sweet and daddy. Daddy, such a beautiful dream. I hate to think it all over. I lost my heart, it seems. I've grown so used to you somehow. Lord, I'm nobody's sugar daddy now, but I'm lonesome. I got the lovesick blues. Well, we couldn't quit singing Hank Williams songs unless we did the first one that he ever put on record. Do y'all know what the first song he ever put out was? Goes like this. Came in last night at half past 10. That baby of mine, she wouldn't let me in. So move it on over. Shove it on over. Move over, big dog. Cause I need a dog moving in. Well, she warned me once and she warned me twice. But I don't take no one's advice. So move it on over.
That's Boxcar Willie. Here's Ray Price with a very typical song of his, Pick Me Up On Your Way Down. This is Ray Price, and this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on...
At Wayfair.ca, we think that when the big stuff ships free, it's just better.
Cover better, brunch better.
Well,
brunch better, rock better, roll better.
Just wondering what has become of this.
Yeah, better!
Oh, Wayfair has free shipping.
Game changer.
Fast better, free better.
Not quite sure why,
Get free shipping on orders over $75.
Not think this is the version we're looking for. This is actually more Boxcar Willie.
Cannonball, cannonball, take an Andy Sullivan will always do. Only got to St. Louis and Chicago, by the way. I'm a hill of Minnesota, weather is blue, what it's for. No kings can be taken on the wall by cannon law. As she pulled into the station, you could hear all the people say, "There's a gal out there from Wembley, he's on his way home. He's a combination of the Wabash Cannonball."
Growing up in Texas in the early 30s was quite an experience. My dad worked for the Katy Railroad. I was born in a little railroad shack in Sterrett, Texas, right alongside the Katy Railroad. My dad worked for that railroad, and they furnished him a house to live in because there wasn't nobody else to live in. Actually, what it was an old tomb shed, a three-room house, a toilet out back, room for a couple hogs. From the front porch to the first rail was probably, I'm going to say about 6 feet, and it was quite an experience because as a kid, I had a train in my yard all the time, and that was my playground. And just like a kid goes and plays on the merry-go-rounds and school today, I crawled all over boxcars and cotton bales.
And I guess the sounds of the outward bound.
I had a television show when I started working for Channel 10 in Lincoln, Nebraska. I kept the television show for 2 years, and we played all over Iowa, western Nebraska, central Nebraska, and southeastern Nebraska, played clear from the Dakotas and Kansas. Wherever Channel 10 reached, we were the hottest thing in those days, and this was in 1960 and 61. We were Marty Martin and the Rangers. Again, we were hot stuff. Because if you were 29 years old and had the big old cowboy hat sitting on the back of your head, you know, fairly good looking, well built, didn't take long till that caused a divorce. I joined the Air Force in May of 1949. I was plowing cotton. I was using an old Oliver tractor. And I was plowing for a man, Mr. Sam Lehman, right north of Red Oak. And I liked about two rows finishing that field that I was plowing. And my buddy drove up in his dad's car, and he hopped up on the back of the cultivators there in the tractor, and I'm going down there watching to make sure it didn't plow up any cotton. And over the noise of the tractor, he said, "Let's go join the Air Force." I said, that's fine with me. He said, "I joined this morning." And I parked the tractor, and Johnny took me to Waxahachie to see the recruiter. And I got the papers, and that night when Daddy came home from work or at supper table, I told Mom and Dad, I said, "Hey, I joined the Air Force today. I got some papers I need for y'all to sign." "You what? No, you're not joining the Air Force. No, I will not sign these papers." And I finally, out of desperation, talked them into letting me go into the Air Force. Lincoln, Nebraska is where I got the idea for Boxcar Willie. I was driving down O Street one day, and the Rock Island Railroad crosses O Street in Lincoln. And I pulled up there in the gates. They got those big gates, arm crossings that come down. And I was the first one. And this train was going real slow, and it was an open door boxcar. And a guy was sitting in the boxcar with his feet kind of crossed, and he just had an old stogie cigar in his mouth. Had old hat pushed back on the back of his head and had an old jacket kind of like I got on. And as he went by, he just kind of nodded, didn't smile much. But he looked like Willie Wilson, who was the chief boom operator at the squadron. And I said, "Well, doggone, there's Willie in a boxcar." And as soon as the train passed, I had to pull over and I took a piece of paper out and I wrote a song called Boxcar Willie. And that's where the name came from. I never had tried Boxcar Willie. So I got out to California, and for some reason our paychecks got all messed up. We didn't have any money. And there was a club out there called Sam's Place, and they had a talent contest. And I thought, I wonder how Boxcar Willie's doing that talent contest. So I borrowed my buddy's car and drove to San Jose and entered that talent contest and won first place. And I think first place was $150. And I think that's the first time I ever really had performed as Boxcar Willie. Then I knew he was going to be a hit if I stuck with him long enough.
In London today is the 1977 Entertainer of the Year at the Grapevine Opry, America's very favorite.
This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me. We'll back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time, and I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever. This is Paul Fromm. And you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com.